Thank you, everyone, for listening and sharing this podcast with others. We love to hear from you as we are preparing for Season 2 programs, and we value your input and appreciate your continued support. You can send us an email, a message on LinkedIn, or send a voice message. Remember to explore continuing education programs on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website. We actually have a live CE webinar on January 26th, taught by Dr. Myrna Mejia on cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain with Hispanic clients. Hope to see y'all there. Now on to today's episode. Stepping into the realm of becoming a psychologist can be a journey of rebirth, a chance to shed old skins and forge new paths. But for some, like psychologists of color, navigating psychodynamic spaces, or those who find themselves confined by traditional career trajectories, the field can feel stifling. Yet, what if we dare to push past the limitations and fuel our creativity? What if instead of shrinking from the unknown, we embrace its wild possibilities? How do we live to be alive and embrace our cultural being? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Tsen. Today, we have Dr. Teresa Tan, a licensed psychologist in California and author and illustrator of the children's book, The Yet Pet. Dr. Tan graduated from the Wright Institute and was trained at the University of California, San Francisco Child Trauma Research Program and at Through the Looking Glass, a disability-focused clinic. Dr. Tan's practice primarily uses psychodynamic approaches in working with children, teens, and adults. She also adopts play and sand trait therapy techniques with children and adolescents. Prior to becoming a psychologist, Dr. Tan was a kindergarten teacher who worked with racially and culturally diverse students with neurodiverse abilities. In addition to a doctorate in psychology, she has a Master of Education from Arizona State University and a Bachelor's in Psychology from Cornell University. As a Taiwanese American, Dr. Tan will be discussing her story of navigating the psychotherapy space in the U.S. as an Asian American wanting to practice psychoanalytically, as well as practice in other new creative ways. Dr. Tan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I'd like to know more about your origin story because you've also written the book, The Yet Pet. Why don't you walk us through your journey? Share with us any memorable events and circumstances that may have influenced how you got into this work.
Yeah, right before I decided to go into grad school to become a psychologist, I was still teaching because I knew I wanted to work with kids and I really like working with people and could just not imagine working in an office or other setting like that. But as a teacher, and so many, at least in the US system, as many teachers can tell you, it's not a system set up for success for most kids. The public school system is really largely influenced by like the Industrial Revolution and kind of like putting people into boxes and kind of setting them up as a factory of like factory learners to like learners do a certain thing and behave a certain way and, you know, push you through rather than like being actually human-centered, child-centered. That's why you have like one adult with 25 kids, even though they're also wildly different and have so many different needs and abilities. And so there was so much struggle with that, like, and I'm not the only one who feels this way, but it's like, I want to help the kids, but like the system is crushing me and like, I can't do all the things I wanted. Like, I felt like I was sneaking in, like teaching in like psychology or like, or emotional regulation, or like I was like sneaking in another recess because I know play is important for kids, which is so kind of ridiculous for kindergarten. Like they need to have play.
That's what kids are supposed to do at your kindergarten level. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, right? But then the system of like, oh, they need to have score a certain level, and people don't know, they're not, teachers are not trained in psychology, right? They're not trained in all these things. And so, yeah, literally was like, oh, I'm going to sneak in a recess. They're not developmentally appropriate setups. So really, really found, just kept getting worn down by that, and knowing that there's something, you know, called therapy and psychologists, and was like, no, it's, I need to change. Like, this isn't good for me. I couldn't keep going. And also because I did have a psychology background, I did have this interest, and I had worked with kids on the spectrum before. And I think also there are other teachers who do this, get this, because they know that I can work well with kids with special needs. I tended to be given all of them, which is also not appropriate. An inclusive environment where kids shouldn't, it was like effectively putting a, making me another special education class when I wasn't. There's the whole setup not conducive to anyone's growth. Like, so I had to get out. And I feel mixed about that, because that's still a system that exists, and there's no perfect system. But I needed personally to get out so I could be alive and functioning and help in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in many ways, observing how the system doesn't cater to a teaching style that mm-hmm. you were hoping to mm-hmm. provide for the students, mm-hmm. you left that environment. Mm-hmm. And how did you make that shift to go into grad school for psychology instead of, say, something else?
Yeah. So then that's the other part, which is my personal experience going to my own therapist and going to my own psychologist and feeling the change and feeling that help and being seen as an individual and having that dedicated space just for me, especially as an Asian American woman, it's easy to put others first, put other needs first, always defer, or always defer my own gratification, or just tend to others' needs. And so I was like, wow, this space is just for me. I get free rein. And that was really special to me and really healing for me in a way that I wanted to provide for other kids and other adults too, not just kids. I went only as an adult, but I think I wish I could have had it as a kid as well. And so, including with my love of working with kids and other people, like, I was like, okay, I think this is what I want to do.
You felt not just heard, you also felt valued.
Valued, yeah. Validated as well, yeah. But valued for sure.
And there is that intersection of being Asian, also a woman, mm-hmm. right? Like you're saying, socialized to defer your needs yep. for others. Yeah.
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 Very practiced at that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. You pursued a doctorate in psychology and decided to get into the space of psychoanalytic therapy.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, and this is one of the things that you want to share your story about, what it's like as an Asian American to navigate that space or even get an entry to that
yeah.
space. Can you just share with me some of the processes and growth areas for you and how you got into that?
Yeah, it's still an ongoing journey navigating the analytic space, more specifically the analytic space within psychology. I first got into it as my second year practicum was at the Wright Institute Clinic, which is psychodynamic, and my supervisor was an analyst at the time, and like so much of what she was, I'm still in contact with her now. The way she practiced, like really going deeper and really staying with someone's experience and not actually, not first and foremost trying to solve anything, but just first and foremost, just accompanying the other in their fully fleshed experience. I loved it. Like I loved going that in depth. And there was one time I remember distinctly somewhere in the middle of the year when I was saying how I love all these things, you know, and as a teacher, like I had 25 kids, how am I supposed to like really get to know each one and spend the time with, you know, and she kind of looks, paused and looked at me. She goes, you're going to be an analyst one day. You're going to be. And I was like, what? And I still was on my mind. I mean, I don't have formal plans to be an analyst officially and not be trained, but there's a lot of the approaches that just resonate with me, and like going into reverie and thinking about them, and dream work I'm really into as well. And so I just really enjoy it. And then the part that can be challenging for me that we alluded to earlier is the space of the analytic field still feels so predominantly white. And I know that the broader field of psychology might still be predominantly white, but in particular, the psychoanalytic field still so predominantly white. Like the percentage might be higher, or that's the feeling I get. And so I started to have this like tension within me, and like almost wondering, like, am I betraying myself, my Asian self, if I were to go deeper into the analytic field? I grew up in a suburb in West Michigan, which was all white. I grew up as like one of the only Asians, if not the only Asian in my class growing up in the predominantly white institution. So I was like, oh, am I going back into that? Like, that's what it elicited. Like, am I, you know, like the Twinkie and the banana, like, am I yellow on the outside? And I'm like, oh my God, am I doing that to myself this time? Like, as a kid, I couldn't choose, but like, am I? So that was a real concern for me. But I was like, but I love working in depth, and that one doesn't have to cancel out the other. But it did really elicit all those old implicit memories and experiences, and like, would I lose my Asian self? But I also am really optimistic at the same time, because I see really exciting role models in the specifically the analytic field. I'm going to shout out Yin Jae Lee for the Asian American Center for Psychoanalysis. They're also the ones who I think who started Asians Do Therapy. And so there's that. And there was like over 300 people showing up at the first session for the Asian American Center for Psychoanalysis. So like, they're not just some, there's a lot of people. And then Mayank Kadaba, who I know personally as well, she's starting a journal called Coloring Psychoanalysis, which is culturally diversify the analytic field. So I'm like, okay, like clearly I'm not the only one. And maybe there's more of us that also feels like it's really white, and add to it.
As you're describing this, there is definitely a lot of internal struggle and battle
Yes.
where, as you mentioned, growing up for you in Michigan, predominantly white environment, you didn't have a choice. And as
Yeah.
you gained awareness growing up in hopes of having more choice to select your environment,
Yeah.
you started to recognize, oh, wait, even in the psychoanalytic space, it's sort of a recreating
Yeah.
that early experience. And that early experience, as we know, amongst Asian Americans, it comes at a cost. As you were saying, you know, it might be a banana, a Twinkie, or whatever the terminology is these days.
I
You
know,
might, am I sacrificing part of who I am, my
yeah.
Asianness? But then later on, you persisted and was able to see a small group. I mean, I say small, but it's really not, as you're
Right,
mentioning, right? There's
right.
actually a lot of folks who are
Yeah.
wanting to get into depth psychology or psychoanalytic therapy, but they're not quite sure how, because maybe the representation isn't widely disseminated. So this is why I'm glad we're having this conversation, because I actually was trained from a psychodynamic perspective, but just because of practical reasons, you know, large healthcare systems lended
Yeah.
itself more towards cognitive behavioral therapy. And so, as you were making that shift, is there anything else you want to share about that story, your journey as you're navigating or getting entry to practicing psychoanalytically?
Yeah, I actually want to say one more thing, which is I think the tension I felt was I felt as though either I had to sacrifice my Asian-ness, or you know, my cultural self, or I had to sacrifice my actual real interest in working such in depth and such anal. I felt like I had to sacrifice one or the other. And I'm realizing now, especially with being emboldened by people like Yin Jae Lee and Mayank Kadaba, and seeing those others, that no, I don't have to recreate, I don't actually have to recreate whatever happened as a child. I'm not going to have to be invisibilize my Asian-ness, but that I can be my full self in the field of psychoanalysis, not sacrifice anything. And in fact, by being in there, this is what enriched the field of psychoanalysis. And so it's still a journey for me, and I'm figuring out my way to do that. But the fact that I have this stance now is really refreshing and enlivening for me.
Yeah. So if we were to add color to the field, mm-hmm. as we're talking about adding your Asianness to the field, can you describe to me what that looks like in practice for therapy?
And thinking about how I'm thinking about like my personal experiences as a patient, and this has been talked about a lot, but like the individualistic versus collectivist, and how there are these orientations to, well, what do you want to say? What do you? And I'm like, well, I'm constantly thinking about my mom and how will she feel about this? You can't just talk to me about me and ignore my mom. But it's kind of like, oh, is it pathology? You know, almost tending towards pathology to think, well, you should be really separate from your mom. And why are you thinking about your mom like that? But it's like, no, my mom is really important. I can't just separate that in the way that you want me to. I don't think it's a pathology to want to think about my mom in this way, in my family a certain way. It's insulting at best, or like harmful at worst, to try to separate that and to try to assert that my individuality is all that matters. And so I felt things like that, or I felt things about having to say, to verbally say, I love you. And if you don't say it, well, how will you show love? And it's like, well, there are many other ways. Many, many, many other ways where it's like undoubted. But I was like, oh, if I don't say it, does that mean it's not happening? Like I've had those kinds of like wonderings and experiences in my own personal therapy, and later being like, no, it's just culturally like different ways of expression, culturally different ways of thinking about yourself and about family. And then I think like people of different cultures, not just Asian American, but others as well, would allow for that instead of feeling like, oh, you're wrong. Like I've started to get this feeling of like, you're kind of wrong for not saying the words, or you're wrong for thinking about your mom so much.
Yeah. So those were some of the implicit messages you were sensing.
Yeah.
Hmm. And, you know, as most therapists are, we're creative folks. And so you've channeled that creativity into this children's book, meanwhile adopting a lot of psychotherapy principles. Can you share with me The Yet Pet? Tell me more about this book.
Yeah, The Yet Pet is something that I got the idea for while I was teaching. Like it was, in a sense, I was the Yet Pet to my kindergarten students. I would be the one. So in the book, there's The Yet Pet says, you know, adds the word yet to like what the main character, this girl, Mia, she says, like, I can't do this. And The Yet Pet goes, yet, like, I can't do this yet. And that was me. I would literally say the word yet after I would hear my kids, the students, be like, oh, I can't do this. And I'd be like, yet, can't do this yet. So that's where it came from originally, that first seed. But it was after training to be a psychologist and then having that time during the lockdown that I could really use my like therapist sense to further hone how I really wanted this book to land, because I was really trying to speak directly, like I had the five-year-old in my mind, and really wanting them to tolerate and can experience frustration while also not letting it stop. Like I was very deliberate to make it not be like, oh, you say yet and everything's fine now. Like, no, like it takes practice. You can adopt a new mindset and you will still encounter obstacles. And that doesn't mean you should stop. And you can still keep going and going. And I honestly used it for myself because I would get frustrated. I was like, people aren't going to publish this book. And oh my God, this book will never get out. And I was like, oh, I got to apply this to myself. Like I haven't published this book yet. Like not yet. Or like, yeah. So, and I still do this now in terms of like, not just like goal oriented towards like, oh, I want to publish a book, but I'm like using it now. Like, I don't know what I'm going to be as a psychologist. I'm still in early career and there's the yet of all the unknowns that are out there. You know, the training was really oriented towards the training I had was oriented towards being like a therapist in private practice or clinics. But I see examples like you creating this podcast. And I just listened to Dr. Mark Standing Eagle Bear. He created like the Sweetgrass Method and all these other things. And I've created this book and I like want to create more books. And like, maybe I'll create a Yet Pet Club group kids therapy. I don't know. This is like, so I'm just like really excited to see what the unknown in an exciting manner. Because I'm really, unknowns can be really scary, but in this case, this is exciting.
Taking these sparks of interactions where you question and possibly motivate yourself and others and doing things differently. And it generates creativity and then taking it elsewhere. And to be able to publish a book, oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. We will definitely link that book in the show notes. And I do hope folks can get that book. I think you can purchase that. It's available on Amazon, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
and I also made it a PDF available for free or for donate whatever you want, pay for what you want, just in case clients might want it, but you know, but maybe can't afford it yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll definitely link that, the page, the Yet Pet page as well. And my understanding is you also did the illustrations.
I did. Yeah. Which also fed, again, part of the creativity. It was just this itch I had to scratch. It's something that as a child, I really enjoyed doing, drawing and illustrating. And then somewhere in middle school, I like tried to kill it because I got so self-conscious and self-critical and like, well, and so it was a rebirth of that. And so that's another celebration for me to allow myself to draw again. And then not only to draw, but then to share it with everyone is a big deal. And just really tapping into all creative sides.
Mm-hmm. You've already discussed the difficulties or challenges navigating or getting entry into the psychoanalytic space and your training as an early career psychologist. In addition to that, in your career as a person of color, what were some additional challenges you faced and overcame that you would be willing to share?
Yeah, there are two things that come to mind that we didn't quite speak about yet. One is that I still find it interesting and yet understandable that even to this day, I still find it hard for me to admit at times that I'm seeing my own therapist to my parents. They know I'm a psychologist. They know I've seen therapists in the past, but I still feel like I'm fighting the stigma even now for like Asian Americans and seeing going outside the family for help like that. And like, oh, what does that mean? Are you less than, are you not doing well? And it's like, no, I'm doing well. And I want to see a therapist, but I just find that interesting. I just wanted to call that out for myself. So that's one thing. And the next thing is, just thinking back into I have spoken about some of my previous therapists, but there was one particular more explicit situation with my previous therapist. So I don't see her anymore, but my therapists have been white. And again, that's part of like the field hasn't, it is still mostly white. But so there was something where I felt like my Chinese background wasn't quite taken into account. It's probably related to one of the things I had already said, but I brought it up in a different later session. I was like, well, actually, I think like, I felt like that was dismissed and like, I want to, you know, address it. And then she said, oh, well, yeah, but you know, my sister-in-law is Chinese. And I was like, okay, oh my God. I was like, what? Don't tell me you're doing this too. I might think other people would do this, but not you, my therapist. Because the thing is I had been with her for a little while and she really did help me in other ways. And so I think that's what got really confusing, because it's easy when it's like the beginning treatment and you're like, oh, this therapist doesn't know anything. But it was more confusing because she was really good in other ways. And so for her to be so good and then for also to say something to me that was so like I don't even know what I almost want to say bad, but like, you know, like to be so helpful and to say something so unhelpful, like, and from the same person was so confusing. And it was really a struggle because the next session I brought up how, okay, but you said your sister-in-law is Chinese. So it was a process. Like I couldn't confront her right then and there, but then I thought about it by myself. And then the next session I brought it up again. And I think she was still defensive. It was still really hard for her to take in. So it's just arduous to having to stand up for yourself to your own therapist who's supposed to be on your side.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really addressing the issue of racism, internalized bias.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, look, you're defensive. It's not my job to help you. You got to figure this out, like, so you can continue to help people.
Yeah. Power to you for bringing it up. Most clients would probably just end the session and never return.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a microaggression in therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I'll say now is in my current therapy, it's a different therapist. I feel a lot more free, both because maybe she is more welcoming, but also because I am much more willing to do it and I kind of think of it as like talking back or to like question, say something. And I'll really call it out with my current therapist, but the difference is I feel like that she does take it in. And so actually it's becoming a very healing experience and not culturally congruent for me, like to speak back, you know, talk back to your elders or like authority figure. She is older too, but also, you know, has this authority position as my therapist. But it is actually becoming really healing to be like, no, that's not right. Or are you saying that because of this? And so I'm glad for that kind of experience as well. Mm. And she's white. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Tan, thank you so much for sharing this process of your journey and getting into this career, publishing the Yet Pet, as well as the experiences that your personal experiences that you're sharing. Is there anything else you want to add today? And more importantly, how do we support you?
That's a great question. I just want to take a moment to think, because we did cover a lot that I did want to put out there. I think maybe I'll just say two more things. One is a quote from Howard Thurman that has resonated with me for years. It's what helped me lean into creating the Yet Pet. And it says, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive.
Wow. Wow, what a powerful message.
Yeah, because I think also in my upbringing, I can be oriented again like towards others. What do you need? What do you need? And what's good for you? What's good for the clients? But this reorients to me, what makes me come alive, and like what helps me can help other people, and what helps me can help me more present, which I think can be such a gift to other people as well. And so kind of this like recentering me is a little different than some of my upbringing.
Thank you for sharing that quote. It's so powerful, because when I hear it, I think about the purpose of living.
Yeah.
To be alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's the second message that you wanted to share?
Just if you want to help me out, if you could go check out the Yet Pet, and feel free. And I would love to hear from anyone if they also resonate with anything I've said. I would love to hear from you as well.
All right, Dr. Tan, any other final thoughts?
No, thank you so much for your thoughtful questions and for having me on.
Well, Dr. Tan, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
A huge thank you to our listeners. If you like what you've heard, please share and subscribe to our podcast, People of Color in Psychology. Other ways to support us include registering for continuing education courses or making a donation on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website. We value your input and appreciate your continued support. You can send us an email, a message on LinkedIn, or send us a voice message on our website. Until next time, this is your host, Jack Zeng.